This is Financial Standard, the definitive source of news, thought leadership and analysis for Australian wealth management professionals. Financial Standard, take the lead.
Welcome to the Financial Standard podcast. My name is Angelique and I am a journalist here at the Financial Standard. Amid a hurricane of regulatory headwinds and an increasingly polarised political climate, ESG approaches to business and investor decision-making are being continually reshaped in 2026. As voluntary commitments give way to mandatory disclosure requirements and domestic greenwashing crackdowns contradict global anti-ESG legislation, Australian investors and businesses are at a unique crossroads. Australian Ethical's Deputy Chief Investment Officer, John Woods, is here to speak with us about what the new year holds for responsible investing and ESG practices. Hello, John. How are you?
Very good. Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Now, John, as we look to 2026, what trends are you seeing in terms of financial performance versus traditional investments? Is the debate about whether responsible investing requires sacrificing returns able to be finally put to rest?
Yeah, look, it's a really good question. And look, I think anything in investing and even in the sporting field, we're always going to see debate. Value investors, growth investors, momentum investors also like to challenge for the best way to invest. Our belief is that sustainable investing is amongst one of those best ways to invest, and the data increasingly gets stronger. I used to be a traditional investor. I've spent about a decade in multi-assets, 5 years investing traditionally and 5 years investing here at Australian Ethical. When I think back to some of those sort of early conversations I had with my peers across the industry when I came over to the light side from the dark side about, you know, what's the catch in this investing style? If I think about sort of momentum investing, the catch there is basically it's a good investment style. It generates, ekes out some returns over time. But you're basically picking up pennies in front of a steamroller. And one day that steamroller rolls you over, and you experience a momentum crash. So it's a good style of investing, but it makes it hard for some people to follow because of this extreme tail risk. In sustainable investing, when we look at the data, and Australian Ethical's been doing this for near 40 years now, what we find is we have typically strong alpha across our funds and lower absolute risk. The catch, however, is there is levels of tracking error. We can't perform like everybody else. If you're choosing to invest sustainably, you're choosing to invest differently, and that means that you'll come with a pattern of performance which isn't like other funds typically experience in the market. You might be seeing really good returns when they're seeing poor returns, and vice versa. You might be seeing poor returns when some part of the markets are seeing good returns. But overall, over a typical investment cycle, business cycle, 7 to 10 years, we see stronger absolute levels of return and lower levels of risk.
Now, John, in terms of regulatory backdrops from an ESG perspective, these have varied globally, with the US seeing the introduction of anti-ESG legislation and the Stop the Clock Directive being operational in Europe. Meanwhile, many other EU nations have successfully implemented labelling laws for sustainable financial products. And domestically, of course, we've seen ASIC has cracked down on greenwashing. How has this affected the responsible investment landscape? And what due diligence should investors consider in 2026 to ensure that investments are aligned with ESG frameworks and sustainable values?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really important question. So when you're investing in a values-aligned way, a sustainable way, the level of trust you need to have in your provider is significant, because the betrayal when they do something that you don't expect is not only a betrayal in performance terms, but a betrayal against your personal values. We've seen a lot of attention in this space, and I think rightfully so. You know, further disclosure, greater transparency. These are important trends to build this trust in investing in a values-aligned way. Europe has been at the forefront of some of those trends, coming up with sort of Article 8, Article 9 funds. But that's also been challenged. What we're seeing is a lot of those rating systems relied on self-assessment. And so the criteria between funds wasn't as comparable as end users would expect, and maybe not aligned with what they were thinking. In Australia, look, we've got good sources of information. RIA does a great job of labelling sustainable funds. More traditional data sources like Morningstar, Lonsec, Zenith, they can help you understand when you look under the hood what the sustainability of a particular fund is. But I think, you know, as an advisor or an investor, you do have to take the time to understand who you're investing with and look at their track record on issues that are important to you. You know, if you're investing, you know, purely for performance, you'll hear a story from a fund manager and you'll look at the performance data and see whether it matches up with what you're being told. If they tell you they're a defensive investor, but they underperform in periods of market volatility like COVID or the GFC, you question the integrity of that story. Ethical investing and sustainable investing is no different. You need to look at what your managers, your investors tell you they're doing, and then see whether it lines up with their actions. I think for me, you know, one of the most sort of disappointing periods in sustainable and ethical investing was when Russia invaded the Ukraine. There are a number of so-called ethical investors out there that held Russian bonds on the eve and in the morning of the invasion. And I don't understand how that would be consistent with the investor who had entrusted their money to them to reflect their values. I mean, I look for a number of red flags. I mean, one of the ones that I think is quite important is asking how an investor's behavior has changed when they've adopted this sustainable or ethical style. If you're spun a story that they just happen to be investing sustainably for the last 40 years without giving consideration to these wider stakeholder views, and it just happened to be a sustainable portfolio, that's a red flag for me. As I mentioned earlier, I came from a traditional background to a more ethical approach. And my portfolio aims to achieve the same goals as it used to, but I do it in a different way. And I find it hard to believe that other investors who are genuinely doing this wouldn't find that they needed to make significant changes. Now, the key one is where you don't have independence between the sustainability team and the investment team. You know, investors like to think they can't be swayed, but because we're dealing with the grey, it's important to separate those potential areas of, you know, desire for profit or returns away from the wider stakeholder issue. And if I think about sort of what's happening in 2026 at the moment, a lot of issues that, you know, ethical investors and sustainable investors have been thinking about for decades are becoming more apparent in day-to-day investment decisions. If we look at, you know, the social unrest, particularly in the US, from some of those social sustainability issues that are beginning to manifest themselves, they've only just started to come to light in mainstream investing circles, but they've been a concern for multiple years within more sustainably focused investment circles. AI is driving demand for water usage. Water scarcity has been a key discussion top amongst sustainable investors for decades. And it's the importance of that separation of investment and ethical research, sustainable research. It ensures you get these broader views, which enhances the overall investment process.
And John, you just spoke on the successes of our current industry-led certification scheme. Is this scheme enough, or should there be more of a push towards labeling financial products domestically in 2026? Because obviously, for years, we've been talking about the introduction of labeling laws in Australia. And while we've seen their successful rollout in Europe recently, they're yet to be introduced.
Yeah, look, I think it's a positive step to try and introduce more defined labels. But it's not enough for an investor to stop at the label. Every morning, I look in the cupboard and I see 4-star labeled healthy cereal for my children. And when I look at the ingredients, if sugar's not number one, it's number two on the list. I think labels can help weed out some of the gross misapplication of sustainable and ethical investing. But when you're trying to invest in a values-aligned way, you need to make sure you've done the diligence to understand the alignment between your investment manager and your own personal beliefs. And there's not too many shortcuts to that process. You need to look at their track record, look at how they're behaving in public spheres and whether that aligns with your views as well. But, you know, it's definitely an improvement and a good start to be bringing more labels into this part of the market.
Definitely. And how are environmental issues such as climate change, exacerbated physical risk, biodiversity risk assessment and emissions reduction practices shaping ESG conversations? And what effect is this having on investors?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting question again. And I think, you know, part of what's sort of started to emerge in more recent years is the timelines for some of these issues are coming a lot closer. So, you know, I started at Australian Ethical 5 years ago, introduced a new capital markets pricing model, CMA, to look at what our returns were for the major asset classes over the next decade. Within that model, we have two key scenarios: a positive climate change scenario where we adopt renewable energies and it brings down the overall cost of energy, and a negative climate change scenario where global warming continues largely unabated. The impacts of those two scenarios over the longer horizon, they were right out at the edge of the 10 years, 5 years ago. But now they've started to creep in to near-term forecasts. If you're thinking about retirement at the moment, the impacts which become more and more evident over the next 5 years, 10 years, which were 10, 15 years away, they start to become really relevant. Now, in investing, we speak a lot about alpha, we speak a lot about fees, but what actually drives how helpful your superannuation investments will be in retirement is beta. It's boring beta. And what matters to how well those investments performs the most is the success of that beta. So if we're in our most positive climate change scenario, the expected returns for that are hundreds of basis points higher than our negative climate change scenario. And it's really beginning to impact, I think, some of the investments that, you know, people are focused on today. Through, you know, last year particularly, we saw the reemergence of investing in emerging markets. Emerging markets are always a tempting investment class with great demographic trends and emerging middle class. But when we look at where the impact of climate change is the greatest, it's in emerging markets. But in emerging markets today are some of the most exciting investment opportunities. So investors have to start balancing these 5 to 10 year risks against the opportunities they're seeing today. And I mean, it's really easy to understand how they manifest. If you're thinking about, you know, I mean, say you're Woolworths here in Australia and you're building a new supermarket. That property development process takes a number of years. If you're not thinking about what, you know, higher levels of physical risk, more increased frequency of floods does to your ability to understand the potential for you to open that store and service customers now, it will be too late in 10 years when you refurbish that store. You won't get the best value out of it. Time horizons in physical infrastructure investing, they're long. You need to start thinking about it now.
And speaking about emerging markets, obviously, as you mentioned, they've been increasingly at the forefront of conversation on responsible investing. And this segment is presenting a lot of new opportunities for investors. How should investors approach responsible investing in emerging markets in 2026? Are opportunities maybe being overlooked due to data gaps, or are the risks being shown to outweigh the potential returns?
Look, investing in emerging markets is tricky. I've been involved personally in the space for a number of years. And, you know, I think as an ethical investor, there are a number of sort of paramount concerns like human rights that need to be considered deeply. You know, we found it a challenging time around 2 years ago when we started to see some of the emergence of, you know, renewable energy manufacturing within China. We're serious about the transition. And we started to see serious development of resources and companies focused on addressing renewable energy needs. So we started an investigation into the space. And when we started to work through some of the detail, you know, some of the challenges were outlined, some basic ones like language, some other, you know, more accessible ones, the data sources, you know, the investment world makes large use of MSCI, Bloomberg, et cetera. There's different data sources in emerging markets trying to capture the same type of information that you need to be across. One of the bits we found that was quite effective in assessing those opportunities was trying to look for companies that had been doing significant work, had significant operations already in the West. So if you think about sort of the risks that underlie supply chain, if you're working with a company, maybe someone like Apple, who's got quite good supply chain practices, or an established European manufacturer, if they're dipping down into sourcing their products from emerging markets, you can start to rely on the resources that you've built in developed markets to critically understand and triangulate the information that you're seeing on the ground in emerging markets. What's interesting is where this starts to line up is from an investment perspective, you know, developed market, emerging market, an attractive thematic is investing in a global best company. Doesn't matter where it's located. And those companies, those best-in-class operators that are serving the developed world as well, they tend to have really well-established relationships with corporates and organizations that you're already familiar with. So that became a really productive vein for us to start investing in emerging markets. So some of the names that come to mind, TSMC, one of the largest chip producers globally, the foundry for NVIDIA, it's in Taiwan. It's located in EM. CATL, the world's largest battery manufacturer. If you want grid scale batteries or you're interested in EVs, there's a good chance that one of their batteries is in your system. They're global leaders. They happen to be located in emerging markets. And what we've seen, and it still persists today, is those type of companies tend to trade at a discount to their developed market peers. So they offer higher returns as well. So that's how we've approached investing over the last 2 years, but particularly over the last 12 months, as people shy away from having 70% of their, you know, global equity portfolio in one market, the US, which is doing some interesting things.
And John, with the maturation of solar and wind technologies and the emergence of newer solutions like green hydrogen and advanced energy storage, where do you see the most compelling investment opportunities in the renewable energy sector for 2026?
Yeah, this probably points a little bit to one of my frustrations as an Australian-based investor. You know, it's not an infrequent question for someone to ask, well, what's the most exciting investment in this space at the moment? And, you know, when I look out at particularly what's listed in the ASX, it's hard to find a lot of great opportunities there. We have a few. Green hydrogen was one of those thematic investments that definitely came through a number of years ago, but it tends to be very much in the small micro cap way. Mm-hmm. When we look at investing in this space, we want to play to the strengths of the geography or the sector we're in. So if you think about how, I guess, Australia's renewable energy has developed, rooftop solar has been an incredible part of that story. Some of the largest rooftop solar penetration in the world, and thus some of the largest complexities in dealing with the grid that's harnessing that energy as well. So we're looking very much in, you know, the venture capital space. We've got a partnership with Climate Tech Partners to access some really exciting and emerging software technology in that area to address some of those needs. It plays to Australia's strength. Why would some of the best climate tech investments be available in Australia? Because this is where we lead and we're a testbed for the rest of the world. We're also seeing some good opportunities, particularly in the private credit space, in the infrastructure debt space. If you think about, I guess, some of the headlines around, you know, private credit investments at the moment, you know, asset quality has been a core concern. What's great about infrastructure is their asset-backed lens and with really strong credit. We're finding because of some of those opportunities are smaller, the banks tend to overlook them, and thus we're able to provide capital where it's needed to support solar projects, particularly in regional communities, at good rates of return as well. When we move out, you know, if we move out to the rest of the world, you look across to New Zealand, there's great opportunities there in the utility sector with a lot of renewable energy. And of course, across the world, we've seen some disruption into some sort of stalwarts of the renewable investing world. Names like First Solar, when, you know, Trump was elected, it halved. Since April, it's doubled. Volatility provides a lot of opportunity for active investors to take advantage of.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, John, and for giving us that insight into responsible investing in 2026.
Great. Always happy to talk about one of my favourite things.
Thank you so much. And thank you for listening to the Financial Standard Podcast.
Thanks for listening to this Financial Standard Podcast. For more information, visit financialstandard.com.au. Please keep in mind that the information discussed in this podcast is general in nature and does not consider personal circumstances. Reliance should not be placed on any content without further independent financial research and advice.